Sherlock Holmes, The Lion's Mane, by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Adapted by Stephanie Baudet. Read by Richard Usher. Chapter 1. My friend, Dr. John Watson, always enjoyed the countryside more than I did. But now that I was retired and living in my little cottage in Sussex, I could see the good things about it. I was glad to be away from the fog and gloom of London, and from the constant visitors. Being the city's most famous consulting detective was not always an easy job. Watson came to visit from time to time, and I was always pleased to see him. I quickly made a friend here, too. His name was Mr. Harold Stackhurst. He was a head teacher. He lived and worked at the local school, the Gables, which was just half a mile away from my cottage. About 20 young men studied there, learning maths, science, and art from the few teachers who also lived within its walls. Harold Stackhurst and I became firm friends the moment we first met. The morning this strange case began, I was looking out of my window at the chalk cliffs and the endless sea beyond them. I could see the beginning of the path that led down to the beach and the mystical lagoon that filled to look like a glistening swimming pool each time the tide came in. The sea was calm. The storm of the night before had been washed away, and the sun was peeking through the cotton-like clouds. It was strangely warm for spring. I could feel the heat already piercing the glass of the window. I decided to go for a walk before breakfast to stretch my legs. As I strolled along the cliff towards the steep slope down to the beach, I heard a shout from behind me. I turned around to see Harold Stackhurst waving his hand in a cheery greeting.
"What a morning, Holmes! I thought I might meet you," he said. "You're going for a swim, I see," I replied, waiting for him to catch up. "Up to your old tricks again!"
He laughed, patting his bag, where a small corner of his towel was poking out between the handles.
"Yes, Mr. Macpherson invited me to meet him for a dip in the lagoon. And the weather's certainly hot enough. He is probably there already."
Mr. Fitzroy Macpherson was the science teacher at the Gables. He had a weak heart after getting rheumatic fever as a child. He was a natural athlete, however, and was very good at any sport that didn't put too much strain on his heart. He went for a swim every day, summer or winter. As a keen swimmer myself, I often went with him, as did many of the students. I was about to ask Harold if I could join them, when I saw Mr. Macpherson coming back up the path from the beach. He was staggering about like a baby animal taking its first steps.
"Mr. Macpherson!" Harold cried out. "Are you all right?"
Suddenly Mr. Macpherson threw his hands into the air and fell to the ground with a terrible cry. Harold and I rushed forwards and turned Mr. Macpherson onto his side. His eyes were glazed and sunken into his face. Beads of sweat rolled off his bald head, and his mouth was gasping for breath. I looked around, not knowing what to do. I wished that Watson were by my side with his doctor's kit. For an instant, a glimmer came back into Mr. Macpherson's face. He whispered a sentence that I couldn't understand.
"Hush!" said Harold. "You'll be all right, Mr. Macpherson. I'm going to get help. We'll get you a doctor."
Mr. Macpherson shook his head, squeezed his sand-coated hands into tight fists, and using the last of his strength said,
"The lion's mane."
Harold and I looked at each other in confusion. I had no idea what Mr. Macpherson meant. There were no lions in Sussex. Then he closed his eyes, took a final shaky breath, and died. Chapter 2. For a moment, Mr. Stackhurst and I were paralyzed with horror. Then, as suddenly as if someone had struck a match, my detective senses switched on. I wiped the unexpected tears from my eyes with the sleeve of my coat, and looked down at the body of Mr. Macpherson. As he had fallen, his coat had slipped from his shoulders, revealing his bare back. It was covered in sand and dark red lines. It looked as though he had been whipped with a thin wire over and over again. Three facts made it clear that this was an extraordinary case. One, whoever had done this to Mr. Macpherson had let him walk away while he was still alive. He could have told us their name if he had only lived a moment longer. Why would the killer do that? Two, Mr. Macpherson was dressed only in his overcoat, his trousers, and an unlaced pair of canvas shoes. Three, I had never seen injuries like those on Mr. Macpherson's back. The weapon that made them must have been flexible, because the long lines curved around his shoulders and ribs. Harold Stackhurst and I were kneeling on either side of the body, staring at the strange injuries, when a shadow fell over us. It was Mr. Ian Murdoch, the maths teacher. He was a tall, thin man, and was known for being quiet and unfriendly. The teachers avoided him, and the students all thought he was odd. His head was always full of maths, his mind so busy with calculations that he ignored everything else. I'm sure that the students would have teased him about it if he did not have such a ferocious temper. But as he stood beside us, looking down at the sorry form of Mr. Macpherson, Mr. Murdoch's face looked for once caring. His eyes were wide and pricked with tears, and his hands shook at his sides.
"Oh, my! The poor fellow! What can I do? How can I help?" asked Mr. Murdoch frantically.
"You can hurry to the police station in Fulworth and report the matter at once," I said. Without a word, Mr. Murdoch nodded and ran off at full speed. Harold was still dazed and stayed by the body. I got to work. My first task was to check who was on the beach. Looking over the edge of the path, I could see the whole sweep of the coastline. It was deserted, except for three people in the distance, who were walking towards the village of Fulworth. I walked slowly down the steep path that led to the beach, my eyes scanning every detail of the surroundings. The path was made of a mixture of clay and chalk. Here and there I saw a man's footprints. Mr. Macpherson's, I assumed. It was clear that no one else had gone down to the beach this way this morning. The rest of the path was clear, having been swept clean by the storm the night before. At one place I saw a handprint with the fingers pointing up the slope. This could only mean that poor Mr. Macpherson had fallen as he tried to climb back up to the cliff. At the bottom of the path was a large lagoon left by the tide as it went out. It looked like a huge swimming pool. At the side of it was Mr. Macpherson's towel on a rock. It was folded and dry. Perhaps he had not swum after all. Yet I could see the prints from both his shoes and his bare feet in the sand. Clearly he had taken his shoes off, ready to swim, but had not gone in. There were also several more handprints, footprints, and scuffs in the sand, as if he had collapsed time and again onto the shore, before gathering enough strength to climb the path up to the cliffs. I stood and thought for a moment, staring out at the deep blue sea. I knew already that this was one of the strangest cases I had ever seen. Mr. Macpherson had been on the beach for less than 15 minutes. Harold had followed him down from the Gables school, so it couldn't have been any longer than that. Yet at some point in that short period of time, Mr. Macpherson had been whipped so savagely that he barely had the strength to crawl away to die. Who had done this terrible deed, and where were they now? It was true that there were many small caves at the base of the cliffs, but the low sun shone directly into them. There was nowhere for the murderer to hide. I thought about the people I had seen on the beach, away in the distance. They surely could not have killed Mr. Macpherson. they were too far away to have had anything to do with the crime. On the sea, two or three fishing boats were bobbing along. It's possible that a sailor or fisherman could have played a part in Mr. Macpherson's death, but I doubted it. There were several suspects, but none of them seemed to fit. Chapter 3. When I returned to the body, I found that a little group of people had gathered around it. Harold was still there, and Mr. Murdoch had just arrived back with Constable Anderson, the village policeman. He was a big man with a ginger moustache. Constable Anderson was quiet and intelligent. He listened to everything Harold and I had to say, took a note of every word, and then said to me, "I'd be glad of your advice, Mr. Holmes. This is a big case for me to handle, and I'll be in trouble with my bosses if I get it wrong." "Certainly. I would advise you, Constable Anderson, to send for your boss and a doctor," I said. "You must not let anything on the beach be touched or removed. The evidence must remain exactly where it is. There may be clues down there that we haven't found yet. In fact, tell your men to search the caves at the base of the cliffs. I doubt that you'll find anything, but it's worth a look." As I spoke, I searched the dead man's pockets. As well as a sprinkling of sand, there was a handkerchief, a notebook, and a small silver case. Sticking out of the case was a piece of paper, which I unfolded and handed to the constable. On it, two lines were written in delicate, swirling handwriting. "I will be there, I promise. Mordy." "It looks like a note between two sweethearts," I said. "A secret meeting, perhaps. Yet it does not mention where or when." The constable nodded, wrote a few words in his notebook, and then placed the note back in the case. He put it, along with Mr. Macpherson's notebook and handkerchief, back in the dead man's pocket. After Constable Anderson had left, I walked back to my house, where my housekeeper had prepared my breakfast. I tried to gather my thoughts, but my mind was awash with confusion. There were so many unanswered questions. Did Mr. Macpherson go swimming or not? Who killed him, and how? And how did they manage to disappear so quickly afterwards? An hour or two later, Harold came round to tell me that Mr. Macpherson's body had been taken to the Gables, where the inquest would be held. As I had expected, nothing had been found in the caves at the base of the cliffs. But Harold had looked at the papers in Mr. Macpherson's desk and found several letters from Miss Maud Bellamy of Fulworth. So now we knew the full name of the person who had written the note.
"The police have the letters, so I could not bring them," said Harold. "There is no doubt that it was a serious relationship. They were in love. I can't see how that could have anything to do with this horrible happening, though."
"They had an appointment with each other, but I cannot imagine they planned to meet at the lagoon," I said. "They would have chosen somewhere more private."
"I agree," said Harold. "And it was only by chance that several students were not with Mr. Macpherson when he was at the lagoon."
"Was it by chance?" I asked. Harold frowned in thought.
"Well, it was because of Mr. Murdoch. He held the students back. He often insists that they finish a maths problem before their break."
Harold sighed.
"Poor chap, he is dreadfully upset about the whole affair. And yet I've heard from the other teachers that Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Macpherson were not friends," I said.
"At one time they weren't," said Harold. "But for a year or more, Mr. Murdoch has been as close to Mr. Macpherson as anyone. This is surprising, since Mr. Murdoch isn't a very friendly person."
"So I've heard," I said. "I seem to remember you telling me that Mr. Murdoch had been cruel to Mr. Macpherson's dog."
"Oh, that blew over.
Perhaps it left some bad feelings," I suggested.
"No, no, I'm sure they were friends," said Harold.
"Well, then, we must explore the matter of Miss Bellamy," I said. "Do you know her?" Harold nodded.
"Everybody knows her. She is the most beautiful person in the neighbourhood, Holmes. And she's as smart as she is pretty. I knew that Mr. Macpherson liked her,
but I had no idea that their friendship had gone as far as love letters and secret meetings.
"Does she have any family?" I asked.
"She is the daughter of old Tom Bellamy, who owns all the boats and bathing huts in Fulworth. He was a fisherman to start with, but is now quite a wealthy man. He and his son William run the business."
"Well, Harold," I said, "I think that it's time we paid the Bellamy family a visit."
Chapter 4. Harold looked a little nervous at the idea of visiting the Bellamy family. I had to remind myself that he was not Watson. He did not have any experience investigating cases with me.
"What excuse shall we give for visiting them?" asked Harold.
"That we're investigating a murder, of course," I said. "Poor Mr. Macpherson did not murder himself. Some human hand used a weapon to beat him to death. We must follow up every lead so we can find the motive and then the criminal."
Harold nodded and put on his jacket. It would have been a pleasant walk through the countryside to Fulworth if our minds had not been focused on the tragedy we had seen. The village of Fulworth lay in a semicircle around the bay. Behind the older buildings, several modern houses had been built on a slope. Harold took me to one of these.
"That's the Bellamy's house, the Haven," he said, pointing up to a large building with a slate roof.
It had a tower attached to the side of it, like something from a fairy tale.
"Not bad for a man who started with nothing." "Good heavens! Look at that!"
The front gate of the Haven had swung open, and a man was walking out. There was no mistaking the tall, straggling figure. It was Mr. Murdoch, the maths teacher. A moment later, we met him on the road.
"Hello," said Harold.
Mr. Murdoch nodded, gave us a sideways glance with his curious eyes, and then tried to pass us by. Harold blocked his way.
"What were you doing in there?" Harold asked.
Mr. Murdoch's face flushed with anger.
"You may be my boss, sir, and I may live in your school, but I do not have to tell you everything I do."
Harold's nerves were on edge after all he had gone through. Usually he was a calm, forgiving person, but now he lost his temper completely.
"After what has happened, you should tell me, Mr. Murdoch, whether you have to or not."
"I will not tell you anything. You have no right to ask me questions about this," replied Mr. Murdoch.
Harold gasped.
"This is not the first time you have been rebellious, but it will be the last," he said. "You will leave the school immediately."
"I had planned to do so anyway," answered Mr. Murdoch. "Today I lost the only person who made staying at the Gables bearable."
Mr. Murdoch turned on his heel and strode off, while Harold stood glaring after him.
"What an impossible man," he cried. "He must be the rudest person I have ever met."
What struck me was not Mr. Murdoch's rudeness, but the fact that he had intended to leave the Gables, to flee the scene of the crime so soon after Mr. Macpherson was killed. I was beginning to suspect him. Perhaps the visit to the Bellamys would make it clearer. We made our way to the house. The butler answered our knock at the door and showed us into the sitting room. Mr. Bellamy was a middle-aged man with a flaming red beard. I introduced myself and said that we were investigating the death of Mr. Macpherson. "Would you mind telling us if there was a close friendship between Mr. Macpherson and your daughter, sir?" I asked. Mr. Bellamy nodded, and then pointed to a young man sitting in a chair in a corner of the room. He was a powerful-looking man with an expression like soured milk.
"Mr. Macpherson's attentions to Maud were insulting. My son there agrees with me," he said.
"I see," I said. "Did Mr. Macpherson ever speak to you about asking Maud to marry him?" I asked.
"No, sir. The word marriage was never mentioned. But there were love letters and secret meetings that neither of us approved of. Maud has no mother, and we are her only guardians. We are determined."
But at that moment, Miss Bellamy herself appeared. Chapter 5. I have never been interested in women. My brain has always ruled my heart. but I had to admit that Miss Bellamy was, as Harold had said, very pretty. Watson would have been the first one to say so. She had pushed open the door and stood wide-eyed and serious in front of Harold and me.
"I know that Fitzroy is dead," she said. "Don't be afraid of telling me the details."
"There is no reason why my sister should be brought into this matter," growled her brother.
Miss Bellamy turned to look at him, her eyes sharpened into slits.
"This is my business, William. Kindly leave me to manage it in my own way. I can see that a crime has been committed. If I can help to find the person who did it, then that is the least I can do for Fitzroy."
Miss Bellamy listened as Harold told her what had happened. Her expression showed a mixture of sadness and fierce determination. It seemed that she already knew me by sight, because when Harold had finished, she turned to me.
"Please, tell me how I can help find the murderers, Mr. Holmes. I need to know who did this to poor Fitzroy," she said. "I want them caught and brought to justice."
For a split second, I saw Miss Bellamy's eyes dart towards her brother. Was it a look of defiance or accusation? Could Miss Bellamy really think that her brother had something to do with Mr. Macpherson's death? "Thank you," I said, bringing my focus back to her. "I would value your assistance. You use the word murderers. Do you think that more than one person is guilty?"
"I knew Fitzroy Macpherson well enough to know that he was a brave and strong man," Miss Bellamy said. "No single person could have beaten him that badly. He would have fought back."
I nodded, and then, rather awkwardly, told Miss Bellamy about the note that had been found in the dead man's pocket. "It is sure to be produced at the inquest," I said. "I know it's private, but can you tell me what it was about?"
"There is no mystery," she said. "Mr. Fitzroy Macpherson and I were engaged to be married. We kept the engagement and our meetings a secret, because Fitzroy's uncle, who is very old and is dying, would have cut him out of his will if he had married without his approval. There was no other reason."
"You could have told us," said Mr. Bellamy.
"I would have if you had shown any interest, Father."
"I object to my daughter having relationships with men who are not equal to her. He was a schoolteacher. He was not good enough for you."
"Your prejudice against him is the reason why I didn't tell you," Miss Bellamy said.
Then she fumbled in her skirt for a moment and finally took a crumpled piece of paper out of her pocket.
"The note you found was in answer to this," she said.
"Dearest Maudie, meet me at the old place on my beach just after sunset on Tuesday. It is the only time I can get away. F.M.
"Tuesday is today," she said.
Her voice cracked as the sadness she had so carefully tried to hide came bubbling to the surface.
"I was meant to meet him tonight."
I looked at the note. "This didn't come by post. How did you get it?"
"I would rather not answer that question," she said.
Her cheeks flushed, and she cast her eyes down to look at her lap.
"It has nothing to do with the matter that you are investigating. Anything that is important, I will be happy to answer."
Miss Bellamy kept to her word. She answered my questions very clearly and, as far as I could tell, honestly. She didn't think that her fiancé had any enemies now, but he used to. "Was Mr. Ian Murdoch one of them?" I asked. Miss Bellamy blushed again.
"Yes, there was a time when they were enemies, but that all changed when Mr. Murdoch found out about Fitzroy and me. They put their differences behind them and became good friends."
This was the second time I had been told about Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Macpherson's friendship, and yet I still couldn't quite believe it. There was something strange about Mr. Murdoch. I was sure that he was hiding something, and I needed to find out what. Chapter 6. A week passed. There had been an inquest to try to find out how Mr. Macpherson had died, but there were no new clues. Harold had begun to suspect Mr. Murdoch, too. He had quietly asked other people about him, and even conducted a secret search of his room, but with no result. I was annoyed at myself. I had been so sure that Mr. Murdoch had something to do with Mr. McPherson's death, and it's not often that I'm proven wrong. I had gone over the whole thing again and again in my mind. I had even revisited the scene of the crime, but was still no nearer to solving the mystery. I could not remember any case that had stretched my powers so much and yet not solved it. And then there was the incident of the dog. My housekeeper heard about it first.
"It's a sad story about Mr. McPherson's dog," she said one evening.
"What happened to Mr. McPherson's dog?" I asked.
"It's dead, sir. It died of grief for its master."
"Who told you this?" I asked.
"Everyone is talking about it, sir," she said. "It became sick soon after Mr. McPherson died, and didn't eat anything for a week. Then today, two of the students from the Gables found it dead, down on the beach, sir. It was right by the lagoon, at the very same place where Mr. McPherson had been before he died."
"At the very same place," I repeated. The story made me stop and think. Dogs did die from grief. I'd heard about it many times before, but at the very same place? Why should it die there? Had it also been the victim of a terrible attack? I needed to find out more about the death of this dog. Within a few minutes, I was on my way to the Gables, where I found Harold in his study. "Harold," I said, "may I speak to the two students who found Mr. McPherson's dog?" Harold agreed, and asked the students to come to his office.
"It lay on the very edge of the lagoon," said one, after I asked them about where they had found the dog. "It must have followed the trail of its dead master."
"Where is the dog now?" I asked.
"It's out here in the hall," said the other student.
Laid on the mat was an Airedale terrier. I gasped when I saw it. Parting the fur on its back was a long red mark. It looked as if it had been hit by the same weapon that had killed Mr. McPherson. From the Gables, I walked down to the lagoon at the beach. The sun was sinking into the sea, and the shadow of the cliff fell across the dark, shimmering water. The place was deserted, except for two seagulls, circling and screaming overhead. In the fading light, I could just see the dog's paw prints around the lagoon and the rock where Mr. McPherson had left his towel. For a long time I stood deep in thought. My mind was flicking through the list of clues as if they were the pages of a book. I knew that one of them was important. One of them held the answer to how Mr. McPherson died. And yet, no matter how many times I ran through them, I couldn't figure out which clue it was. Then at last I turned and walked back home. I had just reached the top of the path when it came to me. In a flash, I realized what was so important. Chapter 7. There was a big attic in my cottage that was full of books. I plunged into the collection and rummaged for an hour before I found a little brown and silver book, which I brought down into my living room. Eagerly, I turned to a chapter that I dimly remembered. My theory was certainly an unlikely one, but it wasn't impossible, and I simply couldn't rest until I knew whether it was right or not. I awoke the next morning with my nose nuzzled in the pages of the brown and silver book. Sleep still fogged my mind, but I couldn't wait to get to work again. I hastily drank a cup of tea and was just putting on my coat to go to the beach when there was a knock at my front door. It was Inspector Bardell of the Sussex Police Force. He was a solid-looking man with thoughtful eyes, and he looked at me with a very troubled expression.
"I'm sorry to disturb you, Mr. Holmes," he said, seeming a little nervous, "but Constable Anderson told me about your deductive powers, and I need your help. This is quite unofficial, of course, and it's best no one knows. But this McPherson case is difficult for me. Should I make an arrest, or shouldn't I?"
"I'm assuming you mean arrest Mr. Ian Murdoch," I asked.
Yes, sir. There is really no one else. Living out here in the countryside, there aren't many people to suspect. If he didn't do it, then who did?
What evidence do you have against him? I asked. It seemed that the inspector thought the same as I had. Mr. Murdoch was a rather unpleasant and unfriendly man with a quick temper. There was the fact that he had quarrelled with Mr. McPherson in the past, and that he was planning to leave the area so soon after the murder. It all made him seem very suspicious.
"I can't let him slip away with all this evidence against him," said the inspector.
"I also suspected Mr. Murdoch at first," I admitted. "But just think of all the gaps in your case. On the morning of the crime, Mr. Murdoch had an alibi. He was with his students until the last minute and arrived from behind Harold and I just moments after Mr. McPherson came up from the beach. Also," I said, "he could not possibly have inflicted those terrible injuries on Mr. McPherson all by himself. He's nowhere near as strong as Mr. McPherson was." "Then we have Mr. McPherson's last words, 'Lion's mane,' which do not connect to Mr. Murdoch at all. And finally, you'd need the murder weapon in order to convict the murderer. We don't know what kind of weapon could make such injuries. How can you find the murder weapon if you don't know what it is?"
"It must have been a flexible whip of some sort," said the inspector.
"Have you looked at the marks?" I asked.
"Yes, I have seen them. So has the doctor," replied Inspector Bardle.
"But have you examined them very carefully with a magnifying glass?" I asked. "They are very strange."
"In what way?" he asked.
I stepped into my study and brought out a large photograph. "This is the way I work in cases like this. I look at every tiny detail," I said. "Here is a close-up of the marks." He took the photo.
"You certainly do things thoroughly, Mr. Holmes."
"I would not be as successful as I am if I were not thorough," I said. "Now look at this wound that goes around Mr. McPherson's right shoulder. Can you see anything odd?"
"No, I can't," the inspector said, looking at it closely.
"Can't you see that it is uneven? It's not a straight red line. It looks as if it's made up of lots of little red dots. What can this mean?"
"Oh, I have no idea, Mr. Holmes. Do you?" he asked.
"Perhaps I do. I may be able to say more soon," I said. "But what I do know is that the moment we find whatever it was that made those marks, we'll find the murderer."
"Oh, I have an idea, but I'm sure it's very silly," said the inspector. "If a red-hot net of wire had been laid across his back, then these darker places would be where the wires crossed each other."
"A very clever idea," I said. "You may be right, Mr. Bartle, or there may be a different cause. But either way, you don't have enough evidence to arrest Mr. Murdoch." The inspector sighed.
"When will you be able to discuss your ideas?" he asked.
"In an hour, maybe less," I answered. The inspector rubbed his chin and looked me in the eye.
"I wish I could see what was in your mind, Mr. Holmes. Is it to do with those fishing boats? Was the murderer one of them?"
I shook my head. "No, no, they were too far out."
"Well, then, is it Mr. Bellamy and that big son of his? They didn't like Mr. McPherson very much. Could they have done this to him?"
"I cannot say anything until I'm ready," I said. "Now, Inspector, we each have our own work to do. Will you meet me here at midday?" Just as the inspector was about to reply, I heard my front door being flung open, followed by a series of heavy footsteps stomping down the hallway. Mr. Ian Murdoch staggered into the room. He was pale, dressed only in his coat and dripping wet. He clawed at the furniture with his bony, sand-coated hands to hold himself up.
"Water! Water!" he gasped, and fell groaning onto the sofa.
He was not alone. Harold was behind him, panting. He looked almost as distressed as Mr. Murdoch.
"Give him some water," Harold said. "He is very ill. He fainted twice on the way here.
I passed Mr. Murdoch a glass of water, which he gulped down before crying,
"Please give me something for the terrible pain."
Then he flung his arms to the side, and his coat slipped from his shoulders. The inspector and I cried out at the sight. Chapter 8. Criss-crossing Mr. Murdoch's shoulders was the same pattern of red marks that had been on Mr. McPherson's back. I could see that the pain was terrible. Mr. Murdoch could hardly breathe, and sweat poured off his face. We gave him a spoonful of medicine, but even that did not help much. I knew that at any moment he might die from the pain. Then Harold had the idea of dabbing the wounds with cooking oil, and that seemed to ease the agony a little. At last, Mr. Murdoch's head fell heavily onto the cushion, and he drifted into a deep sleep. It was certainly not possible to ask him any questions. Harold turned to me.
"Good heavens, Holmes!" he cried. "What is it? Who did this to him?"
"I was about to ask you the same thing," I said.
"I wasn't with him when it happened," Harold explained.
"Where did you find him?"
"Down on the beach, exactly where poor Mr. McPherson had been just before he died," said Harold. "If this man's heart had been weak like Mr. McPherson's was, he would not be here now. More than once I thought he was dead as I brought him here. It was too far to the Gables."
"How did you find him?" I asked.
"I was walking along the cliff when I heard his cry," he said. "He was at the edge of the water, staggering about as if he were walking on ice. I ran down and put his coat around him and then brought him up here. Please, Holmes, use all your powers to solve this case. Life is becoming unbearable. You must be able to do something for us."
"I think I can, Harold," I said. "Come with me now, and you, Inspector. We're going to catch a murderer." We left my housekeeper looking after Mr. Murdoch, and the three of us went down to the deadly lagoon at the beach. On the sand, there was a little pile of Mr. Murdoch's towel and clothes. Slowly, I walked around the edge of the lagoon, with Harold and the inspector following. Most of the pool was quite shallow, but near the cliff it was well over a meter deep. The water was beautiful and perfectly clear. I walked along the sand and onto the rocks by the deep end of the lagoon, peering into the depths. I had reached the deepest and stillest part of the pool when I saw what I was looking for.
"Cyanair!" I cried. "Cyanair! Here is the lion's mane!"
The strange object that I was pointing at did indeed look like a tangled lion's mane. It lay on a rocky shelf a little way under the water, a curious, waving, vibrating, hairy creature with streaks of silver amongst the yellow. It pulsated as it grew big, then small, in and out.
"Where?"
the inspector asked, kneeling by the edge of the lagoon. A small piece of seaweed floated on top of the water, blocking his view. The inspector reached his hand into the pool to brush it aside.
"No!" I cried, as a long, luminous tentacle curled its way through the water towards his hand.
Without a moment's hesitation, Harold grabbed the inspector's shoulders and pulled him back from the water's edge. At the same time, using every ounce of my strength, I pushed a large nearby boulder into the water. When the ripples had cleared, we saw that the boulder had landed on the ledge. A thick, oily scum oozed out from below the stone and stained the water as it slowly rose to the surface. The lion's mane was dead.
"What was that?" asked the inspector, shock written all over his face. "I've lived here all my life, but I've never seen such a thing. It doesn't belong to Sussex."
"You're right, it doesn't," I said. "It may have been the storm that brought it. Come back to my house, both of you. I'll explain more about this peril of the sea." Chapter 9. When we reached my cottage, we found that Mr. Murdoch had recovered enough to sit up. Between shaky breaths and sudden shudders of pain, he slowly explained to us that he had no idea what had happened to him. He had been swimming in the lagoon, and when he neared the deepest spot, a terrible pain shot through him, as if 1,000 matches had been thrown onto his back. It had taken all his strength to get out of the water, but he never saw the thing that had attacked him. I picked up a small book from my desk and held it up. "This is what helped me put the pieces together," I said. "Without this book, we may never have known what happened. The author himself nearly died from contact with this terrible creature, so he wrote about it from experience. Cyanea capillata is its full name. It's a jellyfish. It can be just as deadly as a cobra, and far more painful. If the bather should see a loose, roundish mass of tawny membranes and fibres, something like very large handfuls of lion's mane and silver paper, let him beware, for this is the fearful stinger, Cyanea capillata. He goes on to tell us about his own meeting with one of these jellyfish while swimming off the coast of Kent. These creatures can grow to 3 meters in diameter and have tentacles that are 10 meters long, if not more. Anyone within reach of it is in danger of death. Even at a distance, Mr. J. G. Wood nearly died. The tentacles cause light red lines on the skin that become a series of spots filled with pus. Each of these dots feels like a red-hot needle going into a nerve. I looked up and saw Harold shudder, and Mr. Murdoch nod weakly, his eyes pricked with tears, as if he were reliving the horrible attack in his mind. I put the book down on the desk. It's clear that the jellyfish was washed into the lagoon by the storm, and then attacked anyone who swam near it. Those are the facts, Inspector. I leave this book with you. I'm sure you'll agree that it explains the tragedy of poor Mr. Macpherson's death.
"So I am no longer a suspect?" asked Mr. Murdoch.
The inspector nodded and gave a sorry smile.
"I don't blame you all for thinking I was the murderer," said Mr. Murdoch. "Your suspicions were natural, but I have cleared my name by sharing the same terrible fate as my friend."
"No, Mr. Murdoch," I said. "I already had other ideas before you came here this morning. It's a pity I wasn't out earlier. I could have saved you from this terrible experience."
"But how did you work it out, Mr. Holmes?" asked Mr. Murdoch.
"I am a keen reader," I said, "and I remember everything I have read. The phrase, lion's mane, the last words Mr. Macpherson said before he died, haunted my mind. I knew I had seen it somewhere before, and that it was nothing to do with lions. It does describe the creature quite well. It must have been floating on the water when Mr. Macpherson saw it, and this was the only way to describe it. He wanted to warn us how deadly it was." Mr. Murdoch stood up slowly, gripping onto the arm of the sofa with one hand.
"I ought to explain some things to clear up some of the mystery around my relationship with Mr. Macpherson," he said, turning to Harold. "I loved Miss Maud Bellamy. I know you suspected that, Mr. Stackhurst, and it's true. But from the day she chose Mr. Macpherson, my one wish was her happiness. I was happy to stand aside, to become friends with Mr. Macpherson, and even to carry messages from one to the other. When Mr. Macpherson died, I wanted to be the one to tell Miss Bellamy, in case she found out some other way. That was why you saw me at the Bellamy's home when you visited them. Miss Bellamy was devastated by the news, and so was I. She and Mr. Macpherson had become my closest friends. She didn't tell you about our friendship, in case it somehow made me seem more guilty in your eyes. That is everything. The whole truth."
Mr. Murdoch took a deep breath before speaking again.
"Now, with your permission, Mr. Stackhurst, I would like to get back to the Gables. My bed will be very welcome."
Harold held out his hand.
"I forgive you for everything that has happened in the past, Mr. Murdoch, and I hope that you shall forgive me too. We shall understand each other better in future."
Harold and Mr. Murdoch left my cottage arm in arm. The inspector stared at me with wide eyes.
"Well, you have done it," he cried at last. "I had heard all about you, but I never believed that you would be able to solve this case. It's wonderful!" I shook my head. I was very slow at first. If the body had been found in the water, I would have figured out the answer immediately. It was the towel and the sand that misled me. Poor Mr. McPherson had not been able to dry himself with his towel, and when he fell onto the sand, it absorbed the water off his body, so he appeared to be dry. Both things led me to think he had never been swimming. That's why I didn't consider a sea creature. He nodded. "Well, well, Inspector," I said, as I ushered him towards the door. "I often criticise you gentlemen of the police force for being too slow in solving your crimes. But I was slow on this one. The lion's mane nearly beat me. Nevertheless, I'm glad it's over now. What an adventure to end a career on."
"An adventure?" the inspector scoffed. "You do have a funny way of looking at things, Mr. Holmes."
I smiled. I knew that few people would ever truly understand me and my methods. But Watson did. I couldn't wait to write to him and tell him all about the adventure of the lion's mane. Lagoon. A pool of water next to a river or sea, separated by rocks, coral, barrier islands, or sand. It is usually shallower than the large body of water it sits alongside, but is filled with the same type of water, such as fresh or salt water. It can often provide a home for small aquatic creatures. Inquest. An inquest is made after someone has died, to discover exactly what killed them. A coroner will look at the body and decide how the person died, then discuss it with other doctors and the police. These are often not needed, however, certainly not if I am on the case. I will have likely found the cause of death and the murderer before the inquest is even held.
Sherlock Holmes, The Lion's Mane, by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Adapted by Stephanie Baudet. Read by Richard Usher.
To download Sherlock Holmes activities, please visit www.sweetcherrypublishing.com/resources.